The next thing we're going to cover are these four noble truths. This is the first teaching the Buddha gave in Deer Park at Varanasi. And so these four noble truths, also sometimes called the four Arya truths. Arya is the Sanskrit word for noble, or noble is the translation of Sanskrit, was around before English probably. So these four noble truths, the first one is that what's called the truth of suffering. So that suffering exists, that we have suffering, we experience suffering. And it, while ever we're in this these rebirths, who knows where the next one is, who knows where the last one was, there are these different types of suffering. And so the first, this truth of suffering is, can be explained in many ways, that and it's often explained as the suffering of pain or manifest suffering, the suffering of change, and the all-pervasive suffering of compounded existence, these three types of suffering. So the suffering of pain, you know, these are things like a toothache or whatever, and these are things we can usually deal with physically, with a Panadol, a trip to the dentist, you know, if we're too cold, we can put on warm clothes, this sort of thing. The suffering of change is when something that we think will bring us happiness actually turns into suffering, it changes into suffering. And so, you know, when we buy a new car, for instance, or a new dress, or, you know, a new coffee cup, whatever it might be, we're quite happy with it. We've bought it because it's just the particular one that we want. But then over time, as we use it or drop it or wash it 50 times, it changes. And, you know, we get that experience of looking in a wardrobe and I've got nothing to wear, but the wardrobe's full. And when we bought those things, they were just the perfect thing to wear. So this is, to some extent, they've changed, and to some extent we've changed our opinion about them. But when they break, when they don't work, these sorts of things, then this is the suffering. It was happiness that then becomes. Also, we stand in the sun, we get too hot. We go into the shade, we get too cold. You know, there's this change all the time. Things that brought us happiness, we were warm in the sun until we were too hot, all this sort of thing. And then the pervasive compounded suffering, this is the suffering that pervades all of us living beings in samsara, with these uncontrolled rebirths, this cyclic existence of round and round, experiencing old age, sickness and death. There's no escape from these things. And so it includes the suffering, these types of suffering we experience. So the second noble truth is the truth of the cause of suffering. What causes this suffering at a deep level? We know it's cold because the sun's gone and there's a wind or whatever. But underneath, why? Some people find that great, nice and cool now. Other people are like, wow, it's so cold. So what is it that's underlying all these sufferings? Why do we experience suffering? Why is it that we have this? And so the underlying cause of this, Buddha taught, is because of the actions that we've done with our body, our speech or our mind, and they've been non-virtuous, they've caused harm to someone. The majority of those are driven, sometimes we do things and we don't even realise that there's anyone there, you know, or whatever. We think this thing's, we'll do something helpful and then we break something. So there's no intention. But most of the things we do that cause upset to others are done because of our afflictive states of mind. Our mind says, I want that thing, or you're awful, you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you. And so there are what are called either the three or the six main afflictions. So that when it's a three, it's anger, attachment, and ignorance. These are three, sometimes the three poisonous delusions. And then the other three, when it's six, are pride, doubt, and wrong view. And so these, all the other things like jealousy and resentment and all these other things come along, but they include parts of those ones. And so a lot of the Buddha's teachings are about how to change these, to overcome these, to develop the opposite, to develop non-attachment, non-hatred. When it says ignorance, it means not knowing. It's not a judgment about someone, it's about not knowing. It's confusion about how things exist. And so then what we develop to overcome that is the wisdom that understands and knows things. So the third truth is the truth of the cessation of suffering. And wouldn't we all love that? So the cessation of suffering is nirvana, peace. And as I said before, this can be a step along the way to achieving enlightenment. For some people, some of the teachings say this is the ultimate goal of the teaching is to achieve nirvana. And so we have this saying about there's samsara and there's nirvana. Samsara is this continual round of suffering rebirth. Nirvana is the opposite, peace. Enlightenment includes that peaceful, calm mind, but also has the compassion that drives us to act to benefit others. And so as we get rid of all these mental afflictive states of mind, develop their antidotes, we come to see that they're just temporary. They come and go, and so we can develop ways to keep them away from us, to keep them removed. We're not jealous all the time or unhappy all the time or angry all the time. They just come and go, so we develop ways to prevent them coming back. We develop more patience, so we're not as impatient as we used to be, this sort of thing. And in time, we can eventually purify our minds so they never come back. And so the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path to this cessation of suffering. And so the path, this is, it's really all the Buddhist teachings about progressing on the path to nirvana and enlightenment. And so there are many, many different things that we practice on that path. And some of them, we renounce the things that bring suffering for us and for others. We develop that ultimate compassion, wishing to benefit others, compassion and loving kindness, wanting to help them be free of suffering and to have happiness. And then there's the wisdom teaching. So there are many different types of wisdom, but one of the first wisdoms we need to really become clear about is what it is that helps others, the virtuous actions, what are they, what are the non-virtuous actions, and how can we avoid doing those. So as we start to understand this, we start benefiting others right away. If we avoid actions that bring them harm immediately, then we're benefited because we don't have the negative actions and the karma from that, and they're benefited because we didn't harm them. So all the traditions of Buddhism teach these four noble truths, and as Buddhism moved out of India into all sorts of different countries, different aspects of the Buddha's teachings were emphasised more in some countries than in others. So in some traditions they might practice more meditation or more retreats or more academic understanding, reciting mantras, different things, but all have a combination of these different practices and things that we do to progress on the Buddha's path. So there's an analogy of a medical analogy for these four noble truths. And so, are there any questions before? No? So the thing is that if we're sick, we go to the doctor or the naturopath or someone, but we'll just use doctor as a short word. And so in Buddhism, our problem's not so much being a physical problem, though sometimes we definitely have those, but that underlying that there's, you know, this emotional, mental problem of our having the imprints and the karmic seeds from past negative actions. And so what we're looking at is to overcome them. So when we're the sick person, we go to the doctor, and what we want is for the doctor to tell us what is the problem. What's, you know, is this vague pain in my shoulder? Is this muscle, joint, arthritis, all this? What we're trying to find out is the cause. But in Buddhism, as I say, we're looking at the underlying cause. This is the first noble truth. There is suffering. We rarely go to the doctor if we haven't got some suffering. And then we're looking for the cause of the sickness. So the skilled doctor can identify the right cause and prescribe the right treatment. So if the person hasn't had any training, you know, if you just ask someone over the back fence, they might suggest a treatment that actually doesn't help, might even cause harm. So the Buddhist teachings say that we should check our teachers very carefully before we take them on as our main teacher. And we'll look at what that means next week. But similarly, we need to, if we've got some physical problem, then, you know, whether we see a doctor or a physio or a naturopath or whoever, you know, we know they're qualified. They've got signs and certificates and things like that. We're looking for someone that can benefit. And so this is looking for the cause, the second noble truth. So then the next thing, the doctor explains whatever treatment or medicine there is to cure the illness and stop the suffering as best as they can, given the knowledge we have. And so it's actually medicine that brings us back to the best possible state of health, relieves our suffering as much as possible, whether of the medicine, the, you know, going to the physio, whatever it might be. It's that treatment that reduces the suffering, so we're free of that. And so this is the third noble truth, being free of that. And so then when we get the prescription or the appointment, whatever it is, the appointment at the physio, we have to take that medicine or that treatment. And so the medicine is like the Buddha Dharma, the teachings. And when we apply the Dharma in our lives, this is when we get to that path to the cessation of suffering. So in this analogy, the Buddha's the doctor who prescribes the medicine. The medicine's the Dharma. And the Sangha are the spiritual community who help us practice, help us stay on the right track, like the physio and the chemist and the nurses, all these different people that help. So that's the analogy when we talk about it in medical terms, if you like. And so we can also hope that we want to be free of our suffering for a long time. We want the Dharma to be here with us. We want to be able to remove these different disturbing emotions and not have them come back. So there's a short-term benefit, but we're also looking for a long-term benefit, you know. So this is what we're looking at. And we progress just steadily, one step at a time that we're comfortable with. There's no good rushing into something too fast. If we go in too fast, oh, I'm going to completely throw everything out and I'm going to do this and do that and I'm going to change this and that. If we do these things too quickly, then we think we're going to be enlightened, you know, by this time next year. It's unlikely to work. because we're just jumping from one extreme to the other. We have to just progress steadily. You should not be able to look at a Buddhist, well, a Buddhist like me, yes, but an ordinary Buddhist, you know, it's not like you have to wear some different clothes or you have to do something weird or announce to everyone you're Buddhist. You're working on your mind, your own inner being. That's the most important thing. And if someone sees a change in you and says, wow, you're so patient. This situation's driving me nuts. How can you be so patient? Or you used to drive, this used to drive you nuts as well. And now look at you. Well, you know, if as much as might benefit them, you can say, oh, well, I've been looking at, you know, a bit of meditation, calm mind. And, you know, if they say, yeah, but how, you know, you can, if they're interested, you can talk about. Don't ever try to convert anyone. This is definitely not a Buddhist way. I was actually asked at Chenrezig by someone, didn't I want to convert them? Because I obviously wasn't putting the effort into it. And I said, no, I don't. Buddhism is by attraction, not by coercion. If you're interested in the Buddhist teachings, obviously come to the teachings, find out things. But no, we're not trying to actively recruit Buddhists. Putting out advertising, allowing people to see that there are teachings available, this sort of thing. That's enough. So, and we definitely don't ever try and convert someone who has faith. Now, many people in Australia, a third of people in Australia at the last census said they had no religious faith. They had football and cricket and barbecues and any number of things. But I work with people who are close to the end of their life, and they might say on a census form they don't have, you know, they can't write down I'm Presbyterian or Uniting Church or something like that. But they definitely have faith that their faith or an understanding or a belief that there are ethical ways they should behave. A third of Australians are not going around breaking the traffic rules, driving like hooligans, breaking into people's places, stealing everything from the shops. That's not happening. But so people have a belief in their in ethical behaviour, in helping others, that sort of thing. Australia has one of the highest levels of volunteer engagement in the world. That's because people believe that there's benefit in helping others for free. No, it costs you money. You've got to drive there. A lot of people who help with Meals on Wheels, it costs them petrol and time, but they believe there's benefit. So this mightn't be a faith that you can put a label on. It's ethical behaviour. It's benefiting others. It's being patient and kind. So did we have no questions, Kane?
No, just Louise was wondering if I could put together a quick summary or a list of these, the Four Noble Truths and things. So I've said, yes, I'll get something out to them this weekend.
Oh, right.
Something or other.
Just as well, because you'd kind of planned that, Nithi. You thought that might happen.
Yes. I was planning it already, folks, so...
So would you photocopy
that? So Jan's also said she really liked what you just said, Venerable, that she'd only ever thought of faith meaning just religion, but actually, you know, faith and ethics is a whole thing. And His Holiness talks about that too, doesn't he?
Well, and the teachers often talk about making our life meaningful, which means doing things that benefit others, you know, doing things that... There mightn't be a labelled faith, as I say, but there's people following, you know, their own ethical guidelines and actively doing things to benefit others. These are virtuous activities. These are very beneficial things. So we're going to have a little look. We often, there's this taking refuge. So there's not such a thing as christening or confirmation or whatever in Buddhism, but taking refuge sort of takes a similar thing where you're committing to follow the Buddhist path. Now, this is meant to be something that happens. Sometimes children quite young want to do this, and that's fine. Generally, it's for people who have some understanding of the Buddhist path and want to make, it's a commitment for this lifetime. So it's often talked about the three jewels of refuge. So this is the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. But the real refuge we have, the real refuge, is the Dharma we've incorporated into our minds. And when they say it's the Dharma that helps at the time of death, it's what's in our mind. It's not, how many books we've got on our bookshelf, because that's a bit like having the medicine in the medicine cabinet. It's nice that it's there, but it's not actually impacting our physical body. And so similarly with the Dharma, we need more than just the books.
Yeah, so Jan said just being a decent person and helping others when you can. So that's like your inner Dharma.
Yeah, that's right. And that's that's in this life, there's not a difference. Whatever the spiritual tradition might be, this is the sort of thing that all the spiritual traditions say we should be aiming for. You know, you can be a Christian and doing that, or Muslim and doing that, or Hindu and doing, Buddhism all says we should also be thinking about how this is impacting in our future lives, this life and for our future lives. And the other traditions do too. They say, if you behave in, as you say, a decent human being, helping people when we can, this is the way to get to heaven. If there's a creator God, this is the way to get to heaven. Buddha said he wasn't a creator God, he was an ordinary human being. So, but all of them say our future, whether it's in heaven or hell or a good rebirth or nirvana or not, it's up to us what we actually do. You can't have a whole bunch of servants. If you're really wealthy, it's not that you can have a whole bunch of servants and just tell them what to do. Now, it might be that you do have a whole lot of people to help you and you have a really good idea and, you start an organisation that feeds the homeless or whatever. This is virtuous stuff, but it's in your doing as well. It's not just, you have to actually be putting some energy, whether that's mental or physical or having the idea and, because like the Buddha initially thought, oh, this is too hard. It's a great idea, but it's too hard. So he had, so we also have to, we might have a great idea and not be able to actually accomplish it, but we might be able to pass it on to someone else who can. Who was the first person who thought of Meals on Wheels? I have no idea. I'm sure someone knows. But that's benefited thousands of people. Probably millions of meals have gone out to, And that's a very simple, now it's all set up. It's very simple to go and easily join that group. So when we take refuge in, it's said in the teachings in just a phrase, it's we take it out of fear or faith, the fear being the non-virtuous actions that would lead us to the lower realms, the rebirth where we're not able to even understand that Dharma exists. And where there's just a whole lot of suffering, and out of that suffering we create more suffering and that sort of thing. And faith that the Buddha taught the way, he found the way out of these endless rebirths, found the way to achieve, full enlightenment, nirvana and full enlightenment. He taught both of those because we're different, we have different dispositions. And that this is the way that he did it. So we don't have to go through as much as he figured it out and we can follow. So when we talk about taking refuge, we're thinking about getting away from the storm or the whatever it might be, this unfortunate situation that's happening here and we can't do anything about it, so we leave, whatever it might be. And so when we say we take refuge in these three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma and the Sangha, it is about the Sangha helping us to understand the Dharma that the Buddha taught. But there's commitments for this lifetime. you know, committing to actually following the teaching and doing our best to put them into practice. So there's a ceremony that usually happens about once a year, both here and at Chenrezig. I'm not sure about this year. I'm not sure where we're going with any of that due to all the restrictions. But yes, it's making that commitment to as much as we can apply, understand within us and apply those in our life. Those things like just being mindful. Is this this thing I'm doing, is this helping me on the spiritual path? Is it helping others? What is it causing harm somewhere? Is there a different way I could do it? So Geshe Langri Tampa, that this centre's named after, said, "In all actions I shall learn to search into my mind, and as soon as an afflictive emotion arises, endangering myself and others, I will face and avert it without delay. This is the purpose of life." So that he wrote 8 verses of thought transformation, and it's the third verse, sometimes translated a bit differently, but that's, yes.
So Jen has a question about, can an ordinary person, a member of the public, take refuge like this?
Sure.
What about then if you're living with someone else who doesn't necessarily share your beliefs?
So definitely taking refuge, this is a layperson, these are layperson's vows. In fact, there was a really funny situation, because when we're ordained we have other vows as well. And so some of the ones, I guess, a higher level of vow. And so once when the Dalai Lama was giving refuge vows, one of the Geshe's who was sitting on the stage was just following along, you know, because it's holiness is saying, so repeat after me. And so he's repeating after the Dalai Lama, but the Dalai Lama stopped and said, "Not you. You've got ordained vows. You don't take refuge."
So Jan's wondering, do you need to, like, be in retreat or meditate for
No. We've had quite young people here take refuge, and you can take refuge again and again. And there are a series of things you can commit to, and you can commit to a little bit of them or a lot of them. There are some people who take refuge, you know. When we have refuge ceremony here, there might be 60 or 70 people, and maybe 20 of them are new and get a name. That's the reason we find out, because you get a refuge name, and you can use that then for Dharma things. And then the other people are taking refuge for a second time, because we've probably made mistakes, let's face it. And so, yeah, this is...
The people that then, if you're living with someone who doesn't necessarily share your beliefs?
They don't even have to know you're Buddhist, that you're following that. It's not essential. You don't look any different or anything like that. You were just developing a strong, as much as you can, loving kindness, compassion, patience, these sorts of things. If the person you're living with if they're not there all the time and you can do some meditation and things like that, or they don't care, you know, that they're fine for you to do that, that's probably helpful. But many people who are Buddhists don't. When I first started coming to teachings at Langri Tampa Centre, I was house sharing with a couple of guys who definitely were not Buddhist, and like they didn't care if Inter said I could try doing a one-day retreat on my own, and they just basically didn't care what I did. I was weird enough anyway. Doing a bit of retreat was fine. So. So if there aren't any other questions, one of the things we're trying to do is to, there's this talking about the inner and outer, you know, the inner being and the outer being. So the outer being doesn't need to change. It's the inner being we're trying to talk about. So there's the outer Buddha, if you like, you know, the image of Buddha that we recognise in all sorts of different ways, lying down, sitting up. But we have an inner Buddha, our Buddha potential, our Buddha nature. All living beings have this. And all these different states of mind, it said they're adventitious is the word that's often used, they're temporary, they come and go. And so underneath all of that is this Buddha potential or Buddha nature. And so this is how Buddhahood becomes possible. This is the basis, because when we remove all those and don't allow them back, we don't turn back to situations where we're angry and set out with an aim to hurt someone and say things intentionally to harm someone, this sort of thing. This then allows that Buddha potential to increase and grow. And so Maitreya, who's the next Buddha, who Buddha gave teaching in Tushita now, there are teachings from him, and he said it's like turning, it's like gold, but it's in this mucky mess that's our minds. But the gold's always there. And so whether the gold is all polished and perfect and made into beautiful jewellery, or the gold's buried in the earth, it's still gold. But it just hasn't yet been excavated from the earth and polished and loved and cared for and made into this beautiful thing. So there you go. It's already there. We've just got to gradually bring it out. And so it's through the teachings and understanding our own minds and developing wisdom. So Buddha in Tibetan is Sangi is the word. So San, S-A-N, this refers to eliminating or abandoning all the obscurations to our gold. And Gi refers to the full development, the full realization of our inner gold, if you like. So this, you know, the refuge is a practical, reasonable thing based on reasons and logic, where Buddha achieved what we're setting out to achieve. We have the potential within us. And so, but it took him, sometimes it says 30,000 lifetimes. Hopefully it's not taking us that long. So that's the outer and inner Buddha. We've got the outer and inner Dharma, the teachings, you know, in the books, and the Dharma in here. And the outer Sangha is, you know, the Arya Sangha, the great teachers, the Dalai Lama and Lama Geshe, Lama Zopa, you know, these great teachers. These are the Sangha we need to follow. These help us. They give these precious teachings and initiations and things like that. But it's a Dharma in us. When we're away from our teachers and our books and everything, it's a Dharma in us that helps us. So, are there any other questions before we do a little meditation?
No, just that Jan said that was very encouraging, what she said about refuge, and, you know, very practical.
And don't ever rush into doing any ceremony, initiation, anything that involves vows or commitments. Don't ever, ever do that until you're sure you as an individual want to do that. Sometimes people are influenced by, oh, there's 50 people here are doing this thing, I'm going to do this thing. They all look like they're happy. They all want to do it. I must want to do it. And you're not clear. Buddha said all these things should be based on reasons and logic. We should understand what it means. Refuge in Buddha, Dharma and Sangha, it sounds fine, but if we don't know what that means, it could be anything. It's a whole bunch of Sanskrit words, not even English, heavens above. And then, you know, to really understand whatever the commitment might be, you know, sometimes teachings are given, there's a commitment to say a mantra 100 times, or recently that His Holiness gave a commitment and said, you know, we should try to increase our compassion and increase the harmony in our you know, in our relationships at work, at home, whatever, to actively be trying to you know, not be the cause of disharmony, I guess. You can't make other people be harmonious, but you can avoid being the cause of disharmony. Doesn't mean you've got to agree with, you know, someone who wants to go and shoot someone. Doesn't mean like that. Just not you actively trying to stir someone up, I guess, in the vernacular. So we're going to do a little meditation on Shakyamuni Buddha. Now we've got a little idea of who he is and what he did. So I want to explain the words of the mantra, because people, Miffy's going to put up a picture and the mantra. So, you know, if we just say words and we're not really sure what they mean, or we hope they mean what we think they mean, you know, we might as well be saying Mary had a little lamb or something, because we don't really know. So Tayata means it is like this. This is, you know, that's what it means. Om, this signifies the enlightened state, the positive qualities of the Buddha's body, speech and mind. Muni, you know, like Shakyamuni, this means wise one or able one. Maha is great. Soha, may my mind receive, absorb and keep the blessings of the mantra. So altogether, it's like this. The enlightened qualities of the Buddha's body, speech and mind, the wise one, the great wise one, may my mind absorb and receive and keep the blessings of the mantra. So when we talk about blessings here, the blessings, when we get have blessings from teacher, offer a scarf, have a, you know, a blessing cord, this sort of thing, it's about asking them to bless our minds to be able to understand and keep the teachings and put them into practice. It's not like a blessing and now you're cured of appendicitis. It's not like that. It'd be nice if it was, but... Okay, so we're going to do this. We're going to go over a few minutes, but I guess Miffy won't slap me too hard. So this little meditation on Shakyamuni Buddha. So you know a lot more now, hopefully, about the Buddha than you did at the beginning, about what he did in his life and the benefits that's still bringing us and has brought millions of people since then. So just remembering the Buddha, remembering his name, this is all very beneficial. When we visualize him, so this is also a great benefit because it brings us closer to him. And when we remember that we've got Buddha, not necessarily in the shape of that being, but we have this Buddha potential, Buddha nature, this potential for us to become our Buddha, the more we are connected with the Buddha who's achieved that, this helps us, you know, be drawn towards enlightenment. So this helps lessen, you know, protect ourselves from negative actions and obstacles that are automatic within us, not with it just because that's our habit, or we didn't ever know it was wrong to do these things, whatever it might be. So just sitting comfortably, letting your mind settle. Just watching your breath come and go for a few minutes to develop your concentration, focusing on just one thing. Visualizing or imagining the Buddha lessens our negativities and arouses the desire to become like the enlightened one. Our faith in him increases because we remember his qualities, and the desire to seek his supreme enlightenment, knowledge, compassion, it grows stronger and stronger, making our mind calm and peaceful, preventing the arising of negative thoughts. So our whole visualization is made of pure light, having nothing to do with physical matter. So imagine that at the height of your forehead, a couple of meters in front of you, and as large as possible facing you, is Shakyamuni Buddha's throne, a square platform fully, perfectly adorned with all sorts of precious jewels, supported by 8 white snow lions, 2 at each corner. The snow lions are transformations of the great bodhisattvas and are visualized as alive and made of light. On the thrones a white lotus, which represents renunciation. And on top of the lotus is a sun disk, representing wisdom, and the moon disk, representing ultimate compassion. So these cushions of light are for Shakyamuni Buddha seated upon them. Buddha's holy body is transparent, made of pure golden light. Light rays emanate from every pore of his body, streaming outward in all directions, and through each beam go numberless manifestations of Shakyamuni Buddha. They go to each and every sentient being and ripen their mind. Buddha's clad in the monk's robes. He's very peaceful. Every atom of his holy body has the power to give great realizations. The right hand on his right knee is touching the moon disk in the earth-touching mudra, symbolizing his control over evil, internal and external interferences, by his infinite great love. His left hand holds a bowl containing the 4 nectars of immortality, universal medicine, purification, and transcendental wisdom. Buddha's face is very beautiful. His loving, smiling, compassionate gaze directed towards you, simultaneously encompassing all living beings. He's free of all judgmental or critical thoughts and accepts you just as you are. Buddha's eyes are long, narrow, and very peaceful. His lips are red and his earlobes long. Each feature of his holy body represents an aspect of his omniscient mind. He's the supreme refuge encompassing the teachers, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Buddha looks at you with his compassionate eyes and says, daughter or son of the lineage, if you want to be liberated from the suffering of samsara, I will guide you. visualize lights and beans of nectar, white in color, flowing from the heart of Shakyamuni Buddha, and these enter your body, speech, and mind, purifying disease, spirit harms, negative karma, and obscurations. They are washed out of you just as dirt leaves clothes when they're washed. So we're going to recite the mantra 7 times together. And remembering what the mantra means, as I explained at the beginning.
Tayata mune mune mahamunaya soham. 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 Tayata mune mune mahamunaya soham.
Now visualize rays of yellow light and nectar flowing from Guru Shakyamuni Buddha's heart and entering your body, speech, and mind, filling you with great happiness, dispelling all the wrong, impure conceptions, so that you receive the infinite knowledge of the Buddha's holy body, speech, and mind. Then visualize that the Buddha melts into light and that light absorbs within you. So your body, speech, and mind become one with Guru Shakyamuni Buddha's holy body, speech, and mind. Then beams of light are emitted from the pores of your own body, which is in the aspect of Buddha, towards all living beings, so that their obscurations and negative karma of body, speech, and mind are purified and they all become Buddha. In this way, any beings that appear as Buddha, and all the places that appear as pure places. So rejoice thinking how wonderful it is that you've been able to benefit sentient beings in this way. So I'm going to read some dedication verses that come from a book with many verses, but these are some favourite verses of the Dalai Lama when he does dedications. May all beings everywhere plagued by sufferings of body and mind obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of our efforts. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food, May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the hopeless find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all the medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world.